Hello, I am Gabriel Kamenzouli, and I would like to introduce the third program of It's Debatable. This is a weekly discussion of current affairs in its second series. The program is run by the Department of International Relations in the Faculty of Arts at the University of Malta, as part of the course assessment for research methods. Today's program will be a discussion of the legitimacy of the recent troop surge in Iraq. Today's participatory students are Matthew Bujaya and Sean Peter Gregg. We will also have a short telephone intervention by Mr. Ranier Sudney from the Mediterranean Institute at the University. We will start our program today by having a short presentation of the subject given by Dr. Kaleya.
Thank you, Gabriel. After the Gulf War of 1991, Iraq was suspected of possessing nuclear weapons and became subject to UN-imposed sanctions. Hussein, however, rebuffed the UN inspectors in November 1998, leading to a four-day bombardment of Iraq by the American and British forces. After September 11, the USA targeted Iraq as part of an axis of evil and claimed that the country harbored weapons of mass destruction and terrorists. The USA became determined to attack, and on its insistence, the UN Security Council approved a strongly worded resolution, and weapons inspectors were set to work in November 2002. The USA, however, believed Iraq to be uncooperative, and without a UN resolution, and against the wishes of a number of allies, including France, launched the war on March 20, 2003. Within a month, the first initial phase of the war, that of the conquest of territory, had been completed. The war, however, proved unpopular with the Arab and Muslim world and brought divisions within NATO and the EU. Many countries felt that the USA had acted unilaterally and outside the remit of the United Nations. Though few would argue that the removal of Saddam was for the best, many saw this as an unparalleled example of unbridled US hegemony and not in concordance with democratic values. 8 months after the launching of the war, however, the international community agreed to set aside its differences and work under the remit of UN Resolution 1511 for the reconstruction and the democratization of Iraq. The original USA plan was to run Iraq until it had a constitution and elected government in place, and then depart. The federal government, with a Shia majority, was duly elected in 2005. The forces of a number of allied countries have now been withdrawn. Others, including Britain, are planning to downsize. Those that remain only provide token numbers. However, the USA Army is still in residence, and indeed, in recent weeks, President Bush has announced that he will send in 20,000 extra troops. This decision is unpopular at home, and the Democrats, as a body, have come out against it, as have numerous Republicans. It is also at odds with the policy of managed withdrawal advocated by the Iraq Study Group, a bipartisan commission co-chaired by James Baker, a former Secretary of State. However, President Bush refuses to evacuate, arguing that as a result of the present conditions, this would be untimely. Iraq is still plagued by guerrilla warfare, poor policing, and a lack of law and order. The actions of the elites, driven by rivalries, has further exacerbated a now increasingly irreconcilable cleavage between the Shia majority and the Sunni communities, who are in a majority in the Middle Eastern region. President Bush has reiterated that the American continued presence would be accompanied by a new winning strategy that is rooted in six fundamental elements. These include letting the Iraqis lead, helping the Iraqis in protecting the population, isolating extremist elements, creating a space for political progress, diversifying political and economic efforts, and reviewing the strategy within a regional approach. This in order, he insists, that America fulfills its promise of establishing stable democratic government in the country. Otherwise, Many fear that the alternative may well be the collapse of government and the return to authoritarian rule in Iraq, and rising sectarian violence, not only in the country, but in the entire region, which may well lead to anarchy and renewed warfare. Today's programme will debate whether the actions of President Bush are justified, or whether we are witnessing a new Vietnam in the making.
Thanks, Dr. Kalia, for your contribution. So, we can start now our debate. The new Iraq strategy calls for a troop surge that would help bringing stability and security to Iraq, and to turn over both security and economic issues over to the Iraqis. So, Sean, does this plan have any chance in succeeding?
I begin by saying that although results would not be immediate, I believe that this new strategy has a chance of working. Both U.S. military and administration officials believe that without adequate security, particularly in Baghdad and its suburbs, an area which contains a fourth of Iraq's population, any progress would be difficult, if not impossible. It is believed that the level of violence can be brought down by this upcoming troop surge. Only then can the U.S. military conceivably concentrate on accelerating the training for Iraqi security forces, as well as turning over more territory to fall under their jurisdiction. Bush administration officials have stated that this military option is only one part in a larger and more comprehensive strategy. The new strategy also includes the use of increased funds, of course from the U.S. Treasury, that would be devoted to further reconstruction efforts and further job programs. It is also expected that the United States would turn up the heat on the Shia-led government of Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki. This entails that he'd aggressively crack down on both Sunni and Shia militias, particularly the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr. Al-Sadr and his Mahdi army are believed to be responsible for the killing of hundreds, if not thousands, of Sunnis in a bloody round of sectarian violence and retributions that has gripped the country. This is something we see daily on the news. The Iraqi army and security forces, such as the police, would be crucial to such a process. This being because they are the only armed force of Iraqis that are not divided along sectarian lines. The U.S. strategy also includes an appeal to moderate Sunnis to work harder to reach some kind of reconciliation with the Shia majority, if they don't want to risk being shut out of any role in governance that they might have. However, I must also mention that despite any increase in U.S. strength, it falls to the Iraqis to ensure a positive long-term outcome. While the Iraqi security forces have grown in size and effectiveness, the levels of violence with which that they must cope with have also continued to increase. Thus, fresh efforts to strengthen and train the Iraqi army and police are high on the agenda of this new strategy. A surge of extra troops in Iraq might mean more than increased manpower. It also heralds a shift in overall U.S. military strategy. The incoming U.S. military commander, General David Petraeus, the former commander of the 101st and during the invasion, and a counterinsurgency expert, has stated, and I begin, quote, "With Iraqi forces in the lead wherever possible, the U.S. military's mission is now to provide security within Baghdad by embedding forces within Iraqi units and remaining stationed in key neighborhoods after they have been secured so that violence does not reemerge," end quote. The additional U.S. and Iraqi forces in Baghdad will be able to achieve their mission only if the larger strategy moves forward simultaneously. This includes the political elements, with national reconciliation and a strengthening of Iraqi government institutions, along with the bolstering of the Iraqi economy.
So, Matthew, what are your comments? Do you agree with what Sean said?
Well, to start off my rebuttal, I'd like to say that the situation in Iraq is already unstable, and has been so to some extent or another since the fall of Baghdad in April of 2003. And previous troop surges have not substantially lessened the violence, which has become more of a sectarian and ethnic conflict than anything else. The situation in Iraq is already one of a near civil war, if it is not an actual civil war already. The current situation in Iraq is more complicated, and a band-aid solution such as that of a troop surge may not be enough. There are already three major groups of combatants: the U.S. military, the Shia militias, as well as the Sunni militias. The presence of foreign fighters such as Al-Qaeda operatives, among others, only further complicates the situation on the ground. So far, the Iraqi military has not shown the capability to take on an anti-insurgent and counter-terrorist operation all on its own. The U.S. government has said that it will be capable to do so within several months. However, those U.S. officers training them on the ground have said that while there are Iraqi soldiers who show promise, many more do not seem ready, or even that willing, to take up arms against their own countrymen, even though they may be insurgents. A troop surge will only lead to further casualties. The U.S. has already sustained more than 3,000 servicemen dead and nearly 50,000 wounded or fallen to sickness, both in combat and non-combat operations. The troop surge will continue to drain U.S. military resources worldwide. Already nearly 40% of all troops that had been deployed to either Iraq or Afghanistan were U.S. National Guard, who are assigned to defend U.S. domestic soil and not fight in foreign lands.
So, Matthew, what would better serve the U.S. policy in the Middle East? A rapid withdrawal of troops or a prolonged deployment?
While there is no easy definitive answer for a problem such as that which exists in Iraq, its situation does not necessarily call for further troops, but rather a broad reevaluation of U.S. policy and interests in Iraq. A troop surge has no guarantee that it will succeed, especially based on past results. U.S. personnel have been in Iraq for nearly 4 years now. There are units which have had their tour of duty in Iraq extended several times, and morale has fallen as a result. Instead of deploying fresh troops to Iraq, these units should be replaced. They have more than earned their right to go home and be with those that they love. Perhaps the best idea may be the total reshuffling of U.S. troops and personnel in Iraq, with troops being moved to other more important areas such as Baghdad, rather than being spread all over the country. This problem in Iraq is one which cannot be solved by extra troops. These extra troops may help to lessen the violence, however they cannot build trust and discussion between the warring ethnicities. There has been a growing feeling of animosity towards the U.S. military in Iraq over the last 2 years, and it continues to grow. And if the U.S. is not wanted in Iraq, there is really little the military can do to reduce the violence, because they are as much of a target to the militias as the militias are between themselves. A total withdrawal may not be in the U.S. interest at the moment. However, a surge of troops was not necessarily in the interest of an already overstretched U.S. military, not to mention the fact that public opinion is highly against not only the deployment of further troops, but also of the war in Iraq in general.
So, Sean, what are your comments? What is the best solution?
I begin my rebuttal with a statement by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who hails President Bush's bold decision to order a troop surge and accounts that despite public disenchantment with the war in Iraq, I begin, quote, under present conditions, withdrawal is not an option, end quote. I believe that an assortment of factors concerning Iraq and its strategic position within the Middle East makes any decision for a rapid U.S. withdrawal from the country to be set with serious setbacks for the United States as well as the region as a whole. Firstly, Iraq sits on the world's second largest oil reserves and would become an extremely valuable commodity for whoever controls it. If Iraq were to fall into the hands of radical Islamic groups, such as the like of Muqtada al-Sadr's clique, this would become an extremely dangerous prospect. Secondly, Iraq is wedged between two countries that have shown themselves to be increasingly belligerent, these being Syria and Iran. Both these countries seek to exploit the situation in Iraq so as to increase their influence. Both have been active in their support for sectarian and insurgent groups wreaking havoc throughout the country. Leaving Iraq immediately would only encourage these regimes to step up their drive to dominate the region. In such a case, a stable Iraq would be necessary to curb the influence of these two dangerous countries. Finally, if the partial stability provided by U.S. ground forces were to be removed, the Iraqi government and security forces would most likely fall like a pack of cards at this early stage in their development. The prospect of a civil war, which may already be taking place, and that of a larger-scale regional war, could result in complete chaos for Iraq. In such a case, Syria and Iran could become more directly involved in conflict. Another Iraqi neighbor, Saudi Arabia, has already stated that it might intervene militarily in Iraq in the event of such a withdrawal of coalition forces to curtail any widespread slaughter of Iraqi Sunnis. Moreover, if chaos in Iraq propels Iraqi Kurds to attempt a breakaway and form their own country in the north, the Turks may feel threatened and might intervene so as to quell any nationalist uprising of Kurds within their own borders. Such are just a few of the likely scenarios that may propel Iraq and the region into further instability and chaos. As long as there is still hope that the U.S. may serve a positive role in Iraq, abandoning that country should not be a viable option. Any abrupt American departure will greatly complicate any efforts to stem the terrorist tide far beyond Iraq and might drive the sectarian conflict to genocidal proportions.
Today we are discussing the legitimacy of the UN-sponsored troop surge in Iraq. We have Mr. Rania Afsadni on the phone with us, who is an expert on North African affairs. So, the situation in Iraq is highly dependent on division between the Sunnis and the Shiites. What is the main division between these two groups in Islam?
Well, the division originally arose as a disagreement over leadership. After the death of the Prophet Muhammad, there was a group of Muslims who thought that the next leader should be his closest family member, who was his cousin and son-in-law, Ali. There were other people who didn't think that the criterion should be closeness in terms of family ties, but other criteria. The partisans of Ali were known as the partisans, when the word would be Shia in Arabic. Eventually, Ali did become leader after three other leaders preceded him, but his authority was already fractured. There were people who didn't accept it. He was assassinated, and there was a battle between the partisans of Ali and those who were known as the Sunnis, that is to say, those who followed what they considered to be the true tradition of Islam. So the division begins as a question of a difference over leadership and political authority, but it soon begins to translate itself into a theological difference as well. For one thing, the battle which saw the sons of Ali being killed acquired a dimension of myth in Shiite history. Up till this day, the Shiites commemorate what they call the massacre of the two sons, who are now considered to be martyrs. And this commemoration takes the form of a passion play, which bears some resemblance to the Good Friday processions in Malta, we might say. The theological dimension also had other implications. The leader of the Shiites was now considered to be important also for salvation and not just for the maintenance of law and order. It also meant that the Shiites, due to the victory of the Sunnis, had become a minority in most places in the land of Islam, and therefore acquired an attitude towards political authority which was usually based on an ethos of accommodating the injustice that there is in the world until the true leader of the Shiites would return and restore justice in the world. So the theological dimension fed back into a political dimension. Now, with respect to the current animosities and conflicts in Iraq, these differences are of some relevance, but we should be careful not to project them too back in time. In Iraq, you have one of the few countries in which the Shiites actually form a majority. The other country would be Iran. In other places, they are all minorities. But in this particular case, they are citizens of a country that has been kept out of political power for the last several decades, ever since Iraq acquired independence. So what you have is an animosity that goes back these few decades, and also a sense of threat being experienced by the Sunnis, that if should the Shiites take power, that they would be shut out of the political system and perhaps even be discriminated against. One other point, it is quite clear that the current clashes have also been deliberately instigated by certain terrorists operating either for Al-Qaeda or along similar lines. So there has been a deliberate fanning of the flames. We should be careful not to say that this is an animosity that goes back over 1,000 years.
Thanks, Mr. Ranjef Sadni, for your contribution. Prime Minister Maliki is sometimes seen as incapable of reining in insurgents, especially Shiite militia such as that of Muqtada al-Sadir. Matthew Bejaia, is this particularly true?
Prime Minister Maliki was believed to be a capable, moderate administrator who could help to unite both of the large ethnicities, the Shia and the Sunnis, into one capable Iraqi government. However, ever since his appointment as Iraqi Prime Minister, his track record has been less than impressive. If one takes a look at the situation in Baghdad today, the results speak for themselves. Militias rule large sections of Baghdad, especially Sadr City, formerly known as Saddam City, a suburb of Baghdad in which Muqtada al-Sadr, a militant Muslim cleric, resides and has the majority of his support. His militia, called the Mahdi Army, often benefits being left alone by Prime Minister Maliki. The Mahdi Army is often regarded as a force to reckon with in Baghdad. Maliki was seen as one person who might be able to exercise some sway over Sadr and his lawless sectarian army. But it became clear that influence flowed only one way between Sadr and Maliki in October of 2006, when U.S. forces seized Sadr aide Sheikh Mazen al-Saidi, a suspected organizer of kidnapping rings and death squads. Maliki immediately called for Saidi's release, and U.S. military complied. Killings were on the rise, and Maliki was working to help the leading murderers. Sadr's Mahdi army dropped virtually all pretenses of restraint after the February bombing of a Shia shrine in Samarra went on the attack. With the exception of the Bush administration and a few of the U.S.'s staunchest allies, few believe that Prime Minister Maliki possesses either the will or the authority to attempt to disarm the militias, especially his fellow Shia countrymen's militias.
So, Sean, what are your comments?
I begin my response by saying that Prime Minister Maliki has now agreed to crack down on fighters controlled by his most powerful political ally, which is Muqtada al-Sadr. Previously, al-Maliki had resisted such a move, such as thus a step in the right direction. Maliki knows that there is little patience left for him and his government, and he has since vowed to curb the violence in Baghdad. He has stated that, quote, the Baghdad security plan will not offer a safe shelter for outlaws regardless of their ethnic and political affiliations, and we will punish anyone who hesitates to implement orders because of his ethnic and political background, end quote. Concerning the idea over dividing the country into three parts between the Kurds, Shiites, and the Sunnis, al-Maliki has stated that, quote, success in Iraq requires a united Iraq. Partition would only lead to an increase in violence in the long term. Reconciliation was needed between Iraq's different communities, end quote. Moreover, although acknowledging Syrian and Iranian involvement in fueling the violence within Iraq, al-Maliki has left the door open to these countries for cooperation and negotiation. Regardless of what one may think, such steps, I believe, are positive since they show that the Iraqi government is establishing itself as the legitimate authority within Iraq. In the long run, I believe the Iraqi government would be able to draw the line with both Syria and Iran over how far it would let these two meddle with its affairs. At present, Maliki also continues to hold Bush's support, who calls Prime Minister Maliki a strong and determined leader.
Matthew Bujaya, what is the perception of this new U.S. policy by other Middle Eastern countries, notably Iraq's close neighbors?
Well, there have been mixed reactions to the U.S. decision to deploy further troops to Iraq. Iran and Syria seem to be two of the countries who are most concerned by the additional U.S. personnel in Iraq. Both Syria and Iran have borders with Iraq, and both have been accused by the Bush administration of trying to provoke further sectarian violence by sending arms and agents to Iraq to train the militias there. If this is true, it would be a worrying prospect indeed. And should the U.S. deploy further troops to the area, it would most likely only redouble the efforts of Syria and Iran to send more arms and agents to the country. As a result, the troop surge in Iraq may tie down the U.S. and the country for several years more, as problems are not getting any easier to solve, with some even calling Iraq a proxy war between the United States and Iran. With tensions with Iran getting ever higher, these units may have been better placed on standby to face any future threat rather than being deployed to a political and military quagmire such as Iraq. A Muslim Brotherhood spokesman, whose group is based in Jordan, has said that the U.S., quote, aims to plunge the region into more destruction and bloodshed and leave Iraq with sectarian hatred for many decades to come, end quote.
Sean Gregg, what are your comments to what Matthew Bujaya said?
In my response, I come to state that this new Iraq strategy, illustrated at best by this troop surge, displays the U.S. stance to stand by its commitment in Iraq and not give in to the violence gripping the country. As I have already explained, U.S. friends in the region, such as Turkey, Jordan, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, have more to gain if the U.S. is able to bring security to Iraq. If it withdraws, we would most likely see an expansion in the conflict beyond Iraq's borders and bring about a much worse situation for the entire region. Stability is what these countries want for Iraq, and the U.S., along with its Iraqi allies, are the only force up to the task. The troop surge also serves as a warning to the U.S.'s enemies in the region, such as Syria and Iran. Iran's drive to become a regional hegemon might most likely include increasing its influence in Iraq and fueling the insurgency to rid the country of U.S. troops. The new move shows that the U.S. will not budge from its commitment and will not tolerate Iraq falling under the influence of Ahmadinejad's radical regime in Tehran.
My final question for today is, how is this new plan perceived by U.S. allies and other major international players, such as the European Union, among others?
While some staunch U.S. allies, such as Britain, have backed the United States in their Iraqi policies over the past few years, others, such as traditional U.S. allies, such as France and Germany, have opposed these U.S. policies in Iraq from the very beginning. French Prime Minister de Villepin, who opposed the Iraq war from the very beginning, had said, quote, "Whatever the level of foreign troops in Iraq, things will continue to deteriorate," end quote. From Paris, the conservative Daily Figaro had commented, quote, "George W. Bush has not had a strategy for Iraq for the past 6 months. In view of the doubts of the U.S. public and Congress, he is going into battle. It is the last chance to save his presidency," end quote. Britain, although a fierce supporter of the U.S. policy in Iraq and a key ally when the invasion took place, still had to bring down the troop levels in Iraq in order to both reevaluate its policies and quell the dissent at home. Even Japan, a close U.S. ally, was a bit concerned and cautious in their response. The foreign minister was quoted as saying, quote, "I strongly hope that the U.S. efforts toward stability in Iraq and reconstruction will proceed effectively and bring good results," end quote. For the most part, many European newspapers and publications are against this new plan, and their views are often shared with those of their governments.
Yes, Sean, please.
Most of the European press, as we have seen, has came out against the new strategy that calls for the troop surge. As Matthew has stated, such views are usually close to government perspectives within the EU. However, the governments of these countries have largely remained silent in any large-scale criticism of Bush's new strategy in Iraq. Last month, German Chancellor Angela Merkel visited Bush at the White House and spoke with him at length over the situation in Iraq and the Middle East. At the end of their deliberation, she had only words of praise for the U.S. president. Despite the criticism, it has been universally recognized that Bush's plan is a bold decision that carries considerable risk. Regardless of the criticism, the United States has faced similar difficult situations before. I do not believe that one must continually equate Iraq to Vietnam, since such a stance gets one nowhere. I believe that victory goes to those that endure under the darkest of circumstances. Iraq would most likely be one of the toughest that the United States had to face. The proper response to such a situation is strength and the knowledge that creating a free and stable Iraq in a region in the world that needs it, more than any, is the only option that should be left open.
I would like to thank today's participants, who are Matthew Bujaye and Jean-Peter Grec, who are both Maltese immigrants from the USA. And I would like to also thank Dr. Kalei and Mr. Rani Fsadni for participating as well. Thank you for listening to today's program. Please join us for next week's program on current affairs, which will discuss nuclear weapons proliferation in the Middle East.